Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When the Nazi Third Reich took power in 1930s Germany, it wasn't only books that burned and words that were lost. As the Nazis marched toward the Holocaust, music, too, was suppressed. The music of Jewish and liberal composers banned, its creators killed or hounded into retreat. Now, renowned conductor James Conlon of the Los Angeles Opera is reclaiming that lost world of music for American audiences. This hour On Point, we'll listen with him and hear the story of bringing back a world of music suppressed by the Nazis. You can join the conversation. Did you know this world of Uhlmann, Zemlinsky, Hartmann, Schrecker, or behind us, Erwin Schulhoff? What does it mean to bring back a lost world of music, this lost world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Los Angeles is James Conlon, conductor and music director of the Los Angeles Opera. He's also the music director of the Ravinia Festival, the summer home of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, and the music director of the Cincinnati May Festival. He spent 2 decades in Europe at the helm of the opera in Cologne, Germany, and of the Paris National Opera. The New York Times calls him dynamic, insightful, adventurous. The Washington Post, a maestro on a mission. Since arriving in Los Angeles, he has launched his Recovered Voices project, staging operas suppressed by the Nazis. Maestro James Conlon, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's nice to be with you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Please tell us, describe for us the project you're in the midst of, Recovered Voices.
Well, Recovered Voices is a term we decided to use here in Los Angeles to present operas here. Of course, I do lots of symphonic work elsewhere that were banned by the Nazis, composers who, for whatever reason, lost their podium, lost their forum after the 1930s. And it's a large group and encompasses 2 generations of composition that was that fell off the radar as of 1933, and for various historical reasons, which maybe we can go into, remained off that for many decades after the war. They are not distinct from some names that we know very well, some of whom were able to come to America, establish themselves, like Hindemith, like mostly Schoenberg. They were a part of that entire time and movement. They were all different, but they all suffered. The Recovered Voices composers all suffered in one way or another that their works were banned and then remained unplayed.
James Conlon, we're going to get a music lesson here, but give us a bit of a history lesson first. How did it actually happen that these composers were suppressed? How was their music pushed out of concert halls and off stage? Was it with direct threat to them, their person? Was it, by Nazi partisans taking over the institutions that they had been part of? Who did these, I guess, all men tend to be, and how was their music suppressed?
It was basically suppressed by decree. Their works were forbidden. It happened gradually. Some of the pressure from the Nazis even started before the Nazis had taken power. But after 1933, it became standard practice works. These were mostly Jewish composers, mm-hmm. although not all of them. Their works simply could not be played. And also, some of them were conductors. They lost all of their jobs. They lost their positions, whether it be at conservatories or at the helm of orchestras. Then, of course, most of them, the lucky ones, left, although they are not lucky in the sense that they suffered wherever they were, and their music was banned, and many of them never saw their music performed again. So it was basically a ban. And, of course, those that unfortunately remained in Germany or some in the Czech Republic and so, or Czechoslovakia as it was then, and some of them in Austria, of course, lost their lives in concentration camps.
How did you – we know you've spent a lot of time in Europe. There's a lot of music in Europe. How did you first become familiar or alerted to this world of music, suppressed, essentially lost for decades?
Well, first, all of these names, in one way or other, were known to me, but nothing more than a line in a book. Mm-hmm. Alexander Zemlinsky, who for me is probably the most significant of all of these composers, was a name I had known for decades. But all I knew was that somehow he was involved in the circle around Gustav Mahler, and I knew vaguely that he had some relationship to Schoenberg. In the early 1990s, while I was conducting in Cologne, I was the head of the opera as well as the symphony orchestra. Mm-hmm. While I was there one night, I just happened, as many people do, to switch on their radio while I was coming home late one night after a performance, and I heard a piece that absolutely struck me with its incredible beauty and the brilliance of the orchestration, the passion of this music, and I didn't know what it was. So I did what a lot of people do. Well, I stood in front of I stayed with a car on, polluting the atmosphere for 20 minutes in the front of my house there because I didn't want to miss that. You know how you do. You run into you run inside, and of course it's off.
The best passage is gone, right?
Right. You don't know what it is, right. The lost chord, and then you spend your life wondering what it was. Well, I decided to stay out there because it was just too important to miss. And at the end of that, I learned that I had been listening to the middle of the Mermaid, Die Seejungfrau of Zemlinsky, which is his great, great tone poem. So I said, wow, that's Zemlinsky. I'd heard so much about it. Now, the fortunate thing is I was in Germany, and there are many people in Germany who knew all about this. In fact, my dramaturg in Cologne had already suggested that I look into this piece.
Maestro, so Conlon, let us listen to just a little bit so we can savor, as you describe, that moment. Here is a bit from Die Seejungfrau, The Mermaid, by Alexander Zemlinsky, James Conlon's introduction. Driving home from a concert in Cologne. Of course, he ultimately conducted this performance by the Cologne Philharmonic Orchestra. Alexander Zemlinsky's The Mermaid, based on a popular mermaid fairy tale by Hans Christian Andersen. James Conlon, he composed this when he was 33. He was house conductor at the Vienna Volksoper. I'm not sure what that, the Vienna People's Opera, something like that. So he was part of the musical establishment at that point. What later happened to him?
Well, Zemlinsky was actually, in his way, a part of the musical establishment all through his life. Mm-hmm. He started at the Vienna Volksoper. He started composing very early. He took on two students who are very famous. One, of course, Arnold Schoenberg, and the second was Alma Schindler, later to become Alma Schindler Mahler. He, by the way, was the first of the lovers of Alma, and that was the genesis of this piece you're hearing, The Mermaid. When she moved from him to Mahler abruptly, of course, he was heartbroken. This piece is written in the wake of that, and he was to continue to work out that relationship in the next 15 to 20 years. He was taken on by Mahler, who admired him very much. Mahler commissioned him to write an opera at the Vienna Opera. In fact, it was the only he was the only Austrian composer to be commissioned by Mahler. Unfortunately, the work was canceled. It was already in rehearsal, along with everything else that Mahler had planned when Mahler was basically fired from the Vienna State's Opera. So that work, in fact, remained unplayed until 1980. Zemlinsky went on to have big successes, but unfortunately, during the First World War, when they could not be exported and he could not make a name outside of Germany, he was to go on to become the conductor. He was apparently extremely gifted as a conductor, and he was basically known for that for many years, just as Gustav Mahler had been. and had considered that conducting basically got in the way of his composition, just as Mahler had considered conducting almost a humiliation that he couldn't spend all of his time. He was the head of the German opera house in Prague for many, many years in the 20s, then moved to Berlin, where he joined Otto Klemperer at the Kroll Opera in Berlin. But in 1933, they both had to leave at the time of the Nazis. This is when also Zemlinsky's music was banned. He went back to his native Vienna and remained there until the Nazis arrived in Vienna in 1938, and at the moment of the Anschluss, having already known what was in store because of his experience in Berlin, he left immediately. He emigrated and spent the last 4 years of his life living on the west side of Manhattan, ignored, isolated, in bad health, and with all of his friends, Schoenberg mostly having gone to Los Angeles. They were lonely years to be spent in New York. Mm. He just barely moved to Larchmont, New York when he died in March of 1942.
And now here we are, James Conlon and the Los Angeles Opera, bringing back the music of Alexander Zemlinsky and much more music suppressed during the Nazi period in Germany. Maestro Conlon, please stand by. We have to take a short break here. We're going to come back and hear and learn much more. We're so glad you're with us today. We'll go out of this segment with another Zemlinsky piece. This is a Florentine tragedy. Listeners, you can join the conversation. What does it mean to lose a world, a generation of music, and what does it mean to bring back a musical world suppressed in the Nazi rise? We're at 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about bringing back a world of music suppressed by the Nazis, opera and more from the early 20th century, suppressed in Hitler's rise to power, now being revived in the United States by Los Angeles opera music director James Conlon. Here's the Second Symphony of Victor Uhlmann, composed 1944. Third movement of Victor Uhlmann's Second Symphony, 1944. He died that same year at Auschwitz. James Conlon is bringing this music to American audiences in his Recovered Voices program of works being performed by the Los Angeles Opera. We're listening to some of those in this hour and more. You can join the conversation. What do you hear in this lost world of music, of Jewish composers, of anti-fascists in the 1920s and 30s? And was this the world of your family, your grandparents, Zemlinsky, Uhlmann, Schrecker, Schulhoff? Is this the missing link between Mahler and Schoenberg? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. James Conlon joins us from Los Angeles. James Conlon, this work by Uhlmann, surely one of the last pieces in this period of work that you are helping to revive.
This particular piece was one of the 20 compositions that Victor Uhlmann wrote while he was interned in Terezin, which was the concentration camp that the Nazis had organized as a propaganda front to try to fool the International Red Cross and the rest of the world into
kind
thinking
of show
that the
concentration camp.
Exactly. It was to show that it was actually a very benign thing. And so therefore they were encouraged to have a cultural life. And Victor Uhlmann was probably the leading light of that community, characterized by an extraordinarily strong life-affirming personality. Mm. He inspired others to write. He inspired them to perform. You know, there were famous concerts, a performance of the Verdi Requiem, a concert that was performed under the direction of Carl Ansel for the International Red Cross, but also many opera and chamber music concerts. He himself wrote an opera, The Emperor of Atlantis, which was fully rehearsed and then canceled by the authorities, probably because it had political satire at the center of it. He was an extraordinary man, writing these 20 compositions, which he consigned to his friend, the librarian. They remained missing until they were found in London in the 1970s, and one by one have begun to be played. The opera we are performing here in Los Angeles, for example, which is called The Broken Jug, that's Der Brochene Krug, which is based on a German classic, a theater classic by Kleist, was not found and not even performed until it was premiered in world premiere in Dresden 10 years ago, approximately 10 years ago. This is, of course, the American premiere at Los Angeles Opera. It's a 45-minute comedy. He wrote it just before he went into the concentration camp and sent it back to Prague, where it remained for many, many years. The works in Theresienstadt, or Terezin, are, of course, very significant. I think they were written with his knowledge that he probably would never leave or never survive. But he continued to have a very, very powerful effect on his composer friends, inspiring them to work. And this particular work, which he left unfinished, it was left in the form of a piano sonata with marginalia indicating one instrument, and that was reconstructed, of course, when it was found after the 1970s.
And how long after this composition was he at Auschwitz, and as I understand, finally in the gas chamber? Am I right?
Well, exactly. He went into Terezin on September the 8th, 1942. The visit of the Red Cross was in late summer 1944, after which the transports to Auschwitz were accelerated. He was transported there with his wife, with two other composers, Pavel Haas, Hans Krause, both Czech composers, where they all died presumably together on the 17th or 18th of October 1944.
We're going to hear much more of this music and the music that you are currently performing in Los Angeles or conducting, directing with the Los Angeles Opera. Let me turn to our listeners for a moment, if I may. Walter is calling from West Springfield, Massachusetts. Walter, you're on the air with conductor maestro James Conlon.
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call. Maestro Conlon, I'm thrilled to hear that you are bringing this music back to us. I'm a theatrical sound designer. I have a production of Enchanted April just about to open here in this end of the state, and my palette for that show is classical music. I've been influenced by it all my life, as I'm sure people have heard classical music in movies and lots of popular culture. And now these new colors are being added to the palette that we use, and it is absolutely thrilling, and I'm delighted to hear it, and I wanted to thank you.
Walter, thank you very much. James Conlon, how would you describe the colors that this revival adds to the palette, the sort of missing colors, I guess, that Walter's referring to there?
Well, I would say that it goes beyond that. This is an enormous chunk of musical history that has remained unknown, not investigated, not played. Classical music lives by performance. This is as if you found 200 or 300 paintings from a particular era. I can't imagine you would not want to put them up in a museum and for people to come and see them and have their own experience with it. That's basically what I am trying to accomplish now in the U.S., where there is an openness to this music, but a widespread through no fault of anyone, except for the Nazi regime, an ignorance of these composers and their names. Why is it important? Because we've written the history of 20th century with an enormous omission. Why is it important artistically? Because this is actually an integral part of probably the greatest tradition of music in our Western civilization, which is the German tradition that goes back to before the time of Bach and went on uninterrupted until the 1930s, where this terrible, terrible, terrible moment came that not only was responsible for the murder and the destruction of a great deal of Europe, but was also responsible for an extraordinary act of self-mutilation, because these were not composers who were at the fringe, or these were not men from the moon. These were a part of what had been that tradition. They are all somehow or other interrelated. The names that we know are those basically who survived and were able to bring their message beyond that, like Arnold Schoenberg, like Hindemith. The interconnections are amazing. Zemlinsky taught Schoenberg. He was Schoenberg's brother-in-law and lifelong friend. Schoenberg said at the end of his life he said it at the beginning of his life and at the end of his life that he considered Zemlinsky to be a great composer. Berg was present at the first performances of A Florentine Tragedy, and there's no question that they influenced his Waltzeck. The lyric suite of Berg, it has a quote from the lyric symphony of Zemlinsky as a sort of a secret message. Franz Schreker, an intimate of Zemlinsky, Victor Uhlmann studied with Zemlinsky. Erwin Schulhoff, who was sort of outside of this whole group, nevertheless was completely aware of all those things going on. They were all a part of it. This is also the progeny of Mahler. We're able to experience and judge the giant shadow that Beethoven cast over the 19th century. Well, Mahler cast a shadow, and we're not as aware of that shadow as we should be.
I want to hear more of this music and also hear more of your interpretation of it. But just in this month, you've been performing a couple of pieces, one you just mentioned, but another of Alexander Zemlinsky's Der Zwerg, The Dwarf. This is an opera piece based on Oscar Wilde's The Birthday of the Infanta, this story about what a dwarf given as a gift to a Spanish princess who... Tell us the story, if you would.
It's one of three, in my opinion, great one-act operas based on Oscar Wilde. The first one being Salome. Zemlinsky knew it intimately because he conducted the Viennese premiere of Salome. The second being A Florentine Tragedy, written by Zemlinsky during the First World War, which is a word-for-word translation of a work of Wilde that was published posthumously. And The Dwarf, which, as you say, A Birthday for the Infanta. The Infanta is the daughter of the king of... King of Spain, which in this case, King Philip II of Spain, who is also a famous operatic character in Don Carlo. Therefore, the Infanta is a sister or half-sister of that same Don Carlo. The dwarf, who in a way is a character with whom Zemlinsky, who was small and unattractive and therefore complexed about this, is identified with Zemlinsky. And this dwarf is with a gift to the Infanta. The Infanta, of course, enjoys the contact for the first time as Salome falls in love with Johanna. And the Infanta is fascinated with this voice that is so different from the voice of everything she has heard in the court. It's a humanist. The dwarf is a humanist, a bright and shining personality of poetry and human sensitivity, trapped in an unattractive body. And this is part of Oscar Wilde, the constant contrast between outer beauty, inner corruption, or outer ugliness and inner beauty. This dwarf eventually will fall in love with the Infanta. She will be fascinated, but of course, being a young girl, 16 years old, has no experience, and being the child of privilege, does not know how to properly treat this very sensitive character. The tragedy revolves around a mirror, as another Wildean an idea, very very similar to a picture of Dorian Gray.
Yeah.
The tragedy of the dwarf is that having grown up in the wilderness, does not know that he is a dwarf, does not know about his appearance. Eventually, though warned against it, he sees himself in the mirror, experiences a terrible shock, a loss of identity. Looks to be reassured by the Infanta that he is lovable. The Infanta, immature and to some degree still emotionally shallow, is not able to provide that for him, and he does what most operatic characters do so well. He dies of a broken heart. It's a gripping story and a tearjerker worthy of any Puccini opera.
Let us listen to a bit here from Why Does My Friend Flee, the song from The Dwarf, Der Zwerg. This conducted by James Conlon, with the Cologne Philharmonic Orchestra, just performed in Los Angeles and will be performed again this weekend.
meinen Augen ist. Verzeih, meine Seele fühlt es so. Ich weiß nicht was.
Wie klug. Es ist aus Licht.
Beautiful. From Alexander Zemlinsky's The Dwarf, Der Zwerg. James Conlon there, conducting. Let's take a call from John in Cambridge, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air with James Conlon.
Hello, James, John. Tom, nice to talk to you both. I wanted to ask a quick question to James about, and I'll take my answer off the air, mm-hmm. about what his thoughts are on the literature at the time, especially developments in psychoanalysis. I wonder if the idea that this music is so heavily tied to the unconscious and to developments that Freud and Jung were making at the time, I wonder if that development in psychology, if those developments in culture were contributing at all to the fact that this music was hard to take initially, hard to understand initially, and therefore perhaps maybe put under the carpet. I mean, there's great music of every generation that's been denied and that's been swept under the carpet. And I wonder if there is a connection between the music and the culture.
It's a great question. What about the influence, the I don't know, the shadow of Freud here? And did that have anything to do with the Nazis banning suppression of this? Or was it simply, you know, did they say this is culturally wrong, or simply it's composed by a Jew and therefore out?
I completely agree that Freud's influence is enormous on this whole period. It's to be seen in the visual arts. It's to be seen in literature, and there's no question that it's at this music. I think in particular the music of Franz Schreker, the music of Zemlinsky is heavily infused, as is Berg, as is Schoen. I don't think there's any question about that. It is it's music that's going to get into the subconscious. It's music that is going to look into the mirror of the subconscious. There, the very, very explicit openness about eroticism and sexuality. All of this is to be found in this music, and to some degree, that simultaneously contributed to its success and its fascination for people. And I think, to a degree, had something to do with the Nazis banning it. But I have to say, I don't think there was any real artistic reason for the Nazis banning this. For the most part, they were ignorant of this kind of culture. There were very few of the leading potentates of the Nazi Party who knew anything or cared anything about art. It was thoroughly political. It was thoroughly a part of the genocide. And even though there were other composers who were not Jewish that were banned for one reason or another, and a significant one was Carl Amadeus Hartmann in Munich. Mm-hmm. It was basically just anti-Semitism and part of the terrifying policies of that government. They were basically uncultured people.
We'll hear much more when we come back after a short break. James Conlon is with us, music director of the Los Angeles Opera. His Recovered Voices program, bringing back suppressed music from the Nazi period. You can join the conversation. Is it important to bring these pieces back for cultural completion as a political statement? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Hear the romantic suite from Franz Schreker's Andante. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about bringing back a world of music suppressed by the Nazis, opera from the early 20th century and more, suppressed in Hitler's rise to power, now being revived in the United States by Los Angeles opera music director James Conlon. Behind us here, the Fifth Symphony of Erwin Schulhoff. We'll hear a lot, have heard, and we'll hear more in this hour. What do you hear? What do you think is performing these pieces now, so many decades later, an act of defiance after the fact, of reclamation, restoration, of justice in some way? 800-423-8255 is our number, 800-423-TALK. Behind us, James Conlon conducting the Bavarian Symphony Broadcast Orchestra. Let's take a call from Kim in Scotland, Connecticut. Hi, Kim, you're on the air with James Conlon.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I think that Mr. Conlon's work really highlights what's lost when governments and people fail to act in the face of genocide. Look what beauty we almost lost as a result of the Holocaust. We can only wonder what modern victims of genocide, like the people of Darfur, might go on to create if the world was willing to respond in a meaningful way to the situation in Sudan and others like it.
James Conlon, is that how you see it, reviving what was nearly lost and reviving as Kim says, the price of war, in a way, the price of genocide?
Well, this is absolutely correct from a moral standpoint. This is the modern moral message that needs to be drawn from this, that this continues to go on in our world. And every time there is either a genocide or a war, art is lost. Sometimes you hear, and I consider it a cliche and a rather shallow observation, that there are no lost masterpieces in art. And I've often heard, well, these pieces can't be very good if they've been lost. I would counter with that with saying that this is contrary to history. Since the beginning of civilization, every time there's been a war, there is lost art. I would like to see that concept applied to pre-Columbian art. How can one say that nothing was lost in pre-Columbian America? Before we know that we had some, and we know that there's been an enormous amount lost. So the moral lesson to be drawn is that it should never have happened, and it should not be happening now. This is not the focus of why I'm doing this. I'm focusing this as a musician, as an artist, and for artistic reasons, because this music belongs also to us. It belongs to us as a part of the heritage of classical music that we have inherited, or we should have inherited. But there are moral lessons to be drawn, and absolutely I agree with this caller that that is a very, very important element.
Kim, thanks very much for your call. Let's get another from Bill in Enosburg, Vermont. Hi, Bill, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I have 2 points. One was that I don't have to tell you about this, but it wasn't just music, you know. I mean, the greatest poet of the last century was Bertolt Brecht. I think even right-wingers have to acknowledge that. And he still gets very little play, and for the same reasons, really. The other thing is I want to comment that I disagree with the observation that they had no culture. I don't agree with that. I don't think that's true. They had
You're referring to James Conlon saying that the Nazi bureaucrats, officials, by and large, had no culture.
Yes, I don't think they had no culture. They had a Nazi culture. The recent movie American Gangster, I think, also shows a culture. I disagree with that culture very strongly, but it is, I think, a fascist culture by way of Ayn Rand. And I think it's wrong to let them off the hook that way. They had something that were superimposing on some of the greatest talents that ever lived, but it's wrong to just look at it as though, well, they were a bunch of boors, you know?
Bill, thanks very much for your call. James Conlon, what do you think of that?
I can accept to this comment to the degree that there were mixed in with these people. Certain and many, in fact, many Nazi officers are known to have listened to Mozart string quartets in the evening. I was referring to a lot of the higher echelon of Nazis. You know, it's often thought, for instance, that because Hitler loved Wagner, all of the Nazis loved Wagner. Mm. In fact, there are incidents where Hitler insisted that that those close to him attend the Wagner concert because he wanted them to have this culture, and found that most of them were bored. Apparently several of them fell asleep, and even Hitler gave up at a certain point because he felt that it was hopeless. There are other cases of Goebbels, for instance, who band jazz, the saxophone and jazz were politically incorrect, and yet he had a vast private collection of jazz recordings. So there's as much hypocrisy in that as there is, in certain cases, ignorance, in other cases, hypocrisy. And also, it depends on how you use the word culture. Naturally, they had a culture. But what I'm saying is that their reasons for banning this music was not that of great musicologists or experts in the field of music, and therefore they had analyzed this music and decided that it was not worth preserving. Their act of banning it was a part of their entire political program.
I've seen in your program this year at the Los Angeles Opera, you also have Wagner, Tristan und Isolde. Any second thoughts, hesitation, I don't know, political analysis of what it means to play these pieces? The Dwarf, the Broken Jug, by suppressed Jewish composers in the same season as Hitler's favorite composer.
I see no contradiction. I see an absolute consonance between these two things. Wagner, first of all, Wagner is one of the greatest creative geniuses of Western civilization. And all of these composers, in one way or the other, were living in as his admirers. This is his progeny. The Nazis kidnapped Wagner. Wagner was not a Nazi. He might have been a terrible person. He might have been an anti-Semite. No argument there. But he was also one of the great geniuses. And ultimately, everything is about the music. It is about the greatness of Wagner's music, not his human failings. It is, in my mind, about the great quality to be found amongst these Jewish, mostly Jewish composers, but not all, and their victimization. It is not about the victimization. It is not about the sometimes disagreeable, heinous character of Wagner. It is about Richard Wagner's great music and those two generations that followed Wagner, admired Wagner, in many cases, if not imitated him, took the Wagnerian challenge to their hearts and worked out what Wagner had implied and what Wagner had left as a legacy and what he had left as a challenge. There's no question Schoenberg, Berg, Zemlinsky were composers who, at the beginning of the 20th century, were trying to find a synthesis of the polemics left over from the school of Wagner and the school of Brahms. So it is at the beginning and the end about the music.
Let's listen to another who you mentioned, Carl Amadeus Hartmann, not Jewish in this case, but a prominent anti-fascist who survived the war. This concerto, we'll hear a bit of here, Concerto Funebre, was smuggled to Switzerland so it could be performed. Let's hear. Work of Carl Amadeus Hartmann. Where do you place this work among the works and composers that you're helping revive, James Conlon?
This is an extraordinary composition. What you're hearing behind us at the moment is the first movement, and those are fragments of a Hussite song or chant. What does that mean? This is the Hussite is a representation of the Czech identity. This was written in the wake of Czechoslovakia being given to the Nazis by a composer in Munich, whom, of course, was living in Munich at the time living at the time of Chamberlain's agreement to Hitler. In other words, the capitulation of the West to protect Czechoslovakia from Hitler. Mm. Hartmann writes this quiet lament, this first movement, in a sort of an act of solidarity with the Czechs for this betrayal by the West. And then we'll go on to develop that in the rest of this symphony. It was written at that time. In fact, I have a personal story, which is that I performed this in Munich some years ago. And this piece was dedicated to Hartmann's one-year-old son. And at the end of the concert, a very nice, smiling, elderly gentleman presented him at the. Well, he said, "This is my concerto, my father. dedicated to me. And there he was, the son of Hartman, still alive. And in fact, told me that his mother was still living. I called her the next day, spoke to her on the phone. This is was a very moving experience for me, to know that, there still are those direct links with this time, and that Carl Amadeus Hartman stayed in hiding during the war. He was to emerge after the war. He refused to have any of his pieces performed at that time. After the war, he became a leading light in contemporary music in Munich at the time of the denazification, because his credentials, of course, were unquestionable. He had been one of the early opponents of Hitler, going back to the 20s even, before, at the time of the Putsch. So he was suppressed and had to hide because of his political convictions.
But this time, very real, the memory and the people, very real. I was talking to a friend in New York yesterday, German-Austrian Jewish immigrant, and these names, very familiar to her. I mean, these were composers who were anything but unknown in her circle, in her family circle in those years. Let's take a call from Alice in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Alice, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm just a listener, not a musician, but I respond to this, and I wonder if there isn't a need to hear this kind of music now. I'm wondering about the public response. And also, I can't help but compare it to the popular music after our own Great Depression.
And a need to hear it now because of its particular sound, Alice?
The sound, the romanticism, the richness. I just feel that it's the kind of music which reaches us in this times of turmoil now.
James Conlon, what about the response of your Los Angeles audiences? And, of course, it goes beyond that with your work elsewhere across the country. But how do you find Americans responding to this body of work?
Well, I find it extremely exhilarating and gratifying to see that response. I'm thinking of a recent performance of the Florentine Tragedy with the New York Philharmonic, where we had a standing ovation after every performance of that. And across the country with many of the leading orchestras in America, the Cleveland Orchestra, the Philadelphia Orchestra, the Boston Symphony, the Chicago Symphony, I've seen this reaction over and over again to this music. You know, it is new music in a sense to everybody. There's a saying, a bit of a old adage, an old book read for the first time is a new book. This brings to life the spirit of the time, what the Germans call the Zeitgeist. It brings that time to us, and it's a new experience because so many of these sounds are new to us. And I completely agree with Alice that there is a link here with popular music, not just of the time, but a part of our own American tradition is a part of this story, and it has been the leading names of those who came to America and adapted to America, and the biggest names of all are Kurt Weill on the East Coast and Eric Wolfgang Korngold on the West Coast, who was a child prodigy, also a student of Zemlinsky, who came and made his name and fortune in Hollywood, after having written extraordinary pieces beforehand, lived a life of not just nostalgia, but pain, because he wanted to go back to Vienna. And by the time he got back there, of course, he was completely forgotten. And his music was if known at all, even in our own country, as the man who created the great movie music of his time. So in studying this music, Zemlinsky in particular, Korngold, we will also learn much more about our own history of American popular music, theater music, on Broadway and in the movies.
Maestro, I wonder, heaven forbid we should ever see such times again, but can you work in classical music all the time. Can you imagine today a political movement that would bother to ban classical music?
Well, one always has to worry about any terrible thing like that can happen in our world. Perhaps we think it is, you know, it's impossible, it will never happen, and I hope it does never happen again in this way or in any other way. We have different challenges in 2008 in that regard. There are more subtle forms. They are not suppression. They are not censorship. But they're more subtle of selecting out what gets performance. And a lot of that, frankly, is is economic. In other words, works will not be produced because they will lose money or because they're not popular. lots of serious art, and frankly, even some not so serious art, is selected out of performance because it has shown itself not to be popular, therefore money making, or is feared that it will not be popular or money. So these are subtle forms that I think we have to think about very seriously in our own time. It's not comparable to wholesale suppression, but nevertheless are things that we need to look into our own soul as a culture.
What's next in your Recovered Voices program? We have just half a minute here.
Next year we'll be performing Walter Braunfels, another composer who was banned, a work called The Birds, originally by Aristophanes. And in 2 years, we will give the first performance, first production ever in the United States of any opera by Franz Schreker. And this is his work, Die Gezeichneten. That will be coming up in 2010. These are the two big projects which we are looking forward to in LA Opera, and at the Ravinia Festival with the Chicago Symphony, a look into the music of Franz Schreker this coming summer in 2008.
James Conlon, we wish you luck, and we thank you very much for being with us today. Thank you so much for your time and your work on the project. It's wonderful to hear. Thank you for bringing it back to us, for bringing it to us.
Thank you, Tom. It was a pleasure to be with you.
James Conlon, music director of the Los Angeles Opera. We'll go out with Choral Works by Alexander Zemlinsky. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.